This week, music to be banned in UK prisons over copyright concerns. Cookies and IP addresses no longer needed for tracking you on the internet. And FCC lays the groundwork for blocking BitTorrent traffic in the US. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 13 for Thursday, January 29th, 2010.
And we must do something about the quantum of damages which is being sought, because in a civil procedure on a technical matter, it amounts to blackmail, because the cost of defending one of these things is reckoned to be £10,000. You can get away with asking for £500 or £1,000 and be paid on most occasions without any effort having to be made to really establish guilt. It is straightforward legal blackmail, and we must do something about it by making sure that where damages are asked for, they are at least for first offenders at a rational level.
So I titled this The Act of Threat, and I use the word threat not lightly. It's actually, I think, entirely appropriate here. And I think it's a threat for any number of reasons. I think it's a threat, frankly, to WIPO and the use of WIPO as our main forum for dealing with intellectual property issues on a global scale, particularly the development agenda that has emerged over the last number of years. I think it's a clear threat to transparent policymaking around the issue of intellectual property. And I think fundamentally it's a threat to domestic copyright sovereignty.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last compulse. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for all the links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. Those intro clips that I played off the top of the show, one was the ACTA threat. That was the second one. That was from Michael Geist's blog when he was talking during a lecture. And the first one was the Lord's debate on how to stop ACS Law's legal blackmail, as they refer to it. And for those of you unaware about what ACS Law is doing in the UK, and that's a company going around dropping threats of lawsuits to the people of the UK. And this is from Wikipedia under ACS Law. Actions against suspected file sharers. ACS Law first started claims against suspected file sharers in early 2009. In November 2009, they announced plans to initiate claims against a further 25,000 individuals. A batch of 10,000 letters were sent out in the first 2 weeks of January. ACS Law said that the majority of people chose to settle outside of court rather than fight the claims, but others claimed that only 15 to 40% of people threatened ended up paying. One of ACS Law's clients is the Frankfurt-based company DigiProtect, whose motto is "Turn piracy into profit." ACS Law's use of logic step technology has been the suspect of an investigation by Which, who said that innocent people are being accused. Following the batch of 10,000 letters sent in January 2010, over 150 people contacted Which, saying that they had been falsely accused. In addition, researchers in Washington, D.C. found that the technology often results in false positives. ACS Law responded by saying, "We are happy with the information we get is completely accurate. We are happy that the information we get is completely accurate." The only records of successful cases fought by ACS law are those which were won by default when the defendants failed to appear, and the firm admit they have yet to successfully prove a case in court. ACS law state that it has been said that we have no intention of going to court, but we have no fear of it. Despite the fact there are no precedents for internet account holder being responsible for unauthorized activity on their internet connection in the UK law, a typical letter states that you are responsible for committing infringements either directly or by your authorization, inadvertently or otherwise, third parties to do the same. This has led to criticism that ACS law is misleading victims into thinking that they are responsible for the conduct of unauthorized users of their internet connection. In 2008, a similar law firm, Davenport Lyons, were criticized for the threatening nature of their letters. It is reported that some staff has simply transferred from Davenport Lyons to ACS law. In response to Davenport Lyons' initial campaign against suspected file sharers, the pressure group being threatened was created to enable those wrongly accused to take action. Since the campaign by ACS Law has many similarities, the group now offered the same support and advice to people targeted by both firms. Now, I talked about being threatened last week, and if you're in the UK and you get one of these letters, go to the website first and check out what they have to say about these letters and how you can defend yourself if you are innocent and being accused of copyright violations. Make sure you check out that webpage. And it's good information for anybody in any country to check out because it's very interesting on how the new paradigm of piracy is coming into effect for corporations defending their copyrights, not by going to courts and defending them, but by issuing sort of a copyright tax on the public by sending these letters threatening lawsuits. And of course, most people are just going to pay the amount that they say in the letter because nobody has the money to go to court against these giant corporations which have deep pockets. What are you going to do? You have a letter in front of you that says pay $500 or we're going to take you to court. You go around to lawyers and the lawyers are all quoting things like 10 times the price, 100 times the price of the $500 to $1,000 piece of paper that's sitting in front of you. So in effect, they are blackmailing the people into paying these whatever amounts that come across their door. So they find this, strike this balance between a lawsuit and a fine. So even if you're innocent, what are you going to do? You'd still have to go to court or pay the fine. So even innocent people are paying this fine. This is something very interesting to watch, and the same thing is happening in the U.S. with the RIA and MPAA when people are threatened with lawsuits. People are taking the easy way out by not going to court because they don't have the money to defend themselves. Even if they had something to defend themselves with, they don't have anything to defend themselves with because how do you prove the negative? How do you prove that it's the onus is on the people accusing you of file sharing and they've got all these records and what do you have? You don't have records of not doing it. So it's very difficult to defend yourself. So people just lay out the cash and let the lawsuit go by the wayside. The money for settlement in the U.S. are quoted quite a bit higher in the $5,000 or $6,000 range, but it's still much less than going to court for a lawsuit and ending up like I can't remember her full name, but Jammy, and who is now facing millions of dollars in retributions for paying back to the record company for, I think, 30 songs. I don't have all the stats right in front of me, but very big case in the U.S. We've got an incoming message from Tong Chop. Expectation of privacy. Cloud computing. You absolutely want to maintain that there is a reasonable expectation of privacy while cloud computing. This is what I was talking about last show, about releasing all your data to some of these mega corporations and having it sit on their server. And he's talking about privacy. And he makes some very good points here. If there is not, then it may be searched at will by law enforcement without warrant, but with impunity. There's a difference between expectation of privacy and expectation of security. You should never expect anything on a computer to be secure, but you can expect that it is not viewable by unknown and unauthorized parties. That is the Fourth Amendment issue, free from unreasonable search and seizure, unless there is a warrant for the areas where people have reasonable expectation of privacy. Just like your home may not be secure, you do have a reasonable expectation of privacy. The show keeps getting better. You're totally getting the hang of it. I figure that in 2 months it'll be slick, and from there on out, it'll simply acquire more polish. You're doing important work. Now, he makes a very important point about the difference between privacy and security. And I really haven't focused on that in the past, but those are two separate issues. Privacy is how private your information is from either people working at the company or from the government, from anybody, being able to just go in and take a look at what kind of stuff you're storing on there. And security is whether somebody can hack into this database, whether this data is lying around, whether they've put it on a thumb drive or a hard drive and they're transporting it. So you do have to separate those two ideas from each other and evaluate them separately with each company that you entrust your data with. Now, there's always a level of trust of data with any kind of corporation that you're dealing with, unless you're a hermit living in the woods. People deal with banks, people deal with institutions like your job or a school or even the government. So you do have to deal with these kinds of issues in your daily life, and you have to protect your privacy and your security. So it's a very good idea to look into both of those and pay attention to stories where I focus on privacy and security. If you'd like to contact me and ask a question or leave a comment, just head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form. On to pirate news. ACTA update, anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. ACTA documents, official and leaked. Now, Michael Geist is following the ACTA story very, very closely on his website. So if you want to follow ACTA along every step of the way, he has an excellent update every time something new comes out about ACTA. This is from michaelgeist.ca. Negotiations in the seventh round of the ACTA talks opened this morning in Mexico with civil enforcement issues on the agenda. Yesterday, I pointed out on the developments to date, including a chronology of talks, issues, and leaks that have led to this week's round of discussions. Part 2 of the ACTA guide provides links to the underlying documentation. Governments have been very tight-lipped about the talks. Initially, only a brief summary following the conclusion of each round of the talks was provided. More recently, the agenda of each meeting is disclosed and a summary document, largely confirming internet leaks, has been provided. Links to each of these documents is posted below, and you can go to his website and take a look at that information. That is the official released information. So he's got a summary of every meeting of all the official stuff that's been released. He goes on, of far greater importance are the leaked documents. These have confirmed how the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement is designed to extend far beyond counterfeiting and how it would reshape domestic law in many countries, including Canada. Links to all the leaks are posted below. Note that many are dated and therefore reflect initial thinking, but may have changed over the course of recent discussions. So you can check out his website on all the ACTA documents that are official and unofficial or leaked at michaelgeist.ca. It goes on, world copyright news. Consumer advocates declare war on copyright treaty. This is also talking about ACTA. This is sent in by DC and is from cbc.ca website. The latest rounds of talks on the global anti-counterfeiting agreement kicked off in Mexico on Tuesday, and so did a new wave of opposition to the secret treaty. The anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, which has been in negotiation privately by Australia, Canada, the European Union, Japan, Mexico, Morocco, New Zealand, United Arab Emirates, United States, and a few other governments, is galvanizing consumer and civil liberty groups. A number of these organizations on Monday launched a joint declaration of war on ACTA, which they say threatens the fundamental freedoms of the people living in member countries. The treaty is being motivated by the U.S. entertainment lobbies and would allow internet providers to spy on customers and criminalize the everyday behavior of millions of people, they said. This agreement will restrain certain rights and freedoms, particularly freedom of expression and protection of privacy, the declaration said. It is extremely disconcerting to know that certain American industries have access to ACTA documents, while the European Parliament and consumer groups have been refused such access. Leaked documents from the ACTA negotiations going on for the past year and a half show that a number of anti-consumer provisions are being discussed, the group says. They include allowing internet service providers to cut customers off if sharing copyrighted files is alleged, limiting the interoperability of legally acquired digital content such as music or movies, authorizing border guards to search and seize laptops and MP3 players if copyright infringing materials is found on them, and introducing criminal sanctions for copyright infringements. The group held a web conference on Tuesday to discuss the joint declaration and criticize ACTA governments for their continued secrecy. Jeremy Zimmerman, as spokesman for La Quadrature du Net, an internet rights advocacy in France, said the groups were adopting a vampire strategy in fighting ACTA. "We have to cast a light on them. As a vampire in sunlight, they will dissolve," he said. The groups, which include Washington-based Public Knowledge, the Ottawa-based Canadian Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic, and Quebec's Union de Consommateurs, are demanding the treaty document be open up to public discussion in negotiating countries. In keeping discussions closed, the governments are allowing the business world to limit technology by binding it with laws, when it should be the other way around, said Oliver Charbonnier, an associate librarian at Concordia University in Montreal. "It's a question of what's possible and what's legal," he said. "Industry wants digital locks protected by laws. The treaty has particular resonance in Canada, where the federal government recently concluded the cross-country consultations with the public on an upcoming revision to national copyright laws. The consultations were done after the government twice tried to introduce copyright reform without talking to ordinary Canadians, which provoked online and real-world protests." Industry Minister Tony Clement in December said that whatever domestic laws the government comes up with will trump ACTA provisions. The ACTA negotiations are in fact subservient to any legislation put forward in this House, he said during a parliamentary session in December. ACTA critics don't buy the government's position, however. University of Ottawa professor Michael Geist, who runs a veritable ACTA encyclopedia on his blog, said Canada will face extraordinary pressure from other treaty countries to adopt the agreement once it is concluded at the end of this year. So the story goes on more in depth about Canada's role in it. So it really... It focuses on Michael Geist again, able to get this kind of information out, and people are listening now to what is going on that's being discussed in secrecy and is obviously headed up by the large corporations because they're allowed to see it, but ordinary citizens of the countries that are discussing this are not allowed to see it. Very scary stuff going on. When the corporations have more power than the countries, and the countries are not allowed to let their citizens in to see what is being negotiated, the rights being negotiated away, and people will be, you know, not be allowed to access information on the internet under some of these proposed things, like the three strikes laws of just being accused. It's a very quick way of silencing people on the internet. By just accusing them of something so innocuous as a copyright violation and possibly getting thrown in jail for something that is primarily monetary. You're not damaging person or property. This is a copying of data, and they're proposing criminal punishments for such things. So this is something that we don't want to have happen, that we don't need a blanket laws for all the countries in the world. Laws don't work for every country the same. There's different needs for different countries, but the corporations are trying to enact this blanket law over the whole world and be able to rule them from their office desk. And this has gone way too far. So hopefully the word will get out more and more in the public about what these people, what the corporations are doing behind closed doors in secrecy when the citizens of the country don't know what is going on. So hopefully more and more leaked documents get out and people are standing up and talking about what is going on in these secret chambers when they're being discussed. And I didn't report on this other story. I was thinking of including it, but somebody was in these negotiations that had to sign a non-disclosure agreement, which is something that is asked people to sign when they go into these negotiations, like, you know, citizens or people outside of the lobby groups and outside of the government, when they're able to sit in somehow. Sometimes they're able to sit in, but somebody was twittering from inside the negotiations and they booted them out. And that's how secretive they are. They get you to sign a non-disclosure agreement so you can't discuss anything you've heard or have seen in the negotiations, and you're not allowed to talk about it at any point. So somebody got booted out. You can check up on that news story and take a look at on the internet. It was just kind of a fluffy piece, but it kind of emphasizes how secretive these negotiations are at giving away your rights. Next story, in privacy news from the U.S., judge tosses NSA spy cases. This is from Wired.com. A federal judge is dismissing lawsuits accusing the government of teaming with the nation's telcos to funnel Americans' electronic communications to the NSA without warrants, National Security Agency. U.S. District Judge Von Walker's decision was a major blow to the two suits testing warrantless eavesdropping and executive branch powers implemented following the 2001 terror attacks. The San Francisco judge says the courts are not available to the public to mount that challenge. A citizen may not gain standing by claiming a right to have the government follow the law. Interesting. A citizen may not gain standing by claiming a right to have the government follow the law, Walker ruled late Thursday. He noted that the plaintiffs include most every American connected to the internet or have used a telephone, meaning the lawsuit boils down to a general grievance and are barred. The decision came days after a government audit showed the telecom companies and FBI collaborated for 4 years between 2003 and 2007 to violate federal wiretapping laws. Judge Walker said that the lawsuits in essence cannot be brought because they are citizen suits seeking to employ judicial remedies to punish and bring to heel high-level government officials for the allegedly illegal and unconstitutional warrantless electronic surveillance program or programs now widely, if not incompletely, aired in the public forum. Cindy Cohn, the legal director of the EFF that brought one of these cases, said the decision means when you're trying to stop the government from doing something illegal, and if the government does it to enough people, the courts can't fix it. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, which said it would appeal Walker's order, and others originally brought suit against AT&T and other telecommunication companies in 2006. That was a month after George W. Bush acknowledged a terror surveillance program after it was disclosed to the New York Times. The EFF, based on a former AT&T's documentation, claims the program was and continues to be a dragnet where carriers funnel customer communications to the NSA without warrants. Bush, however, acknowledged the program as one in which his war powers granted him the authority to monitor Americans' telecommunications without warrants if the subject was communication with somebody overseas and was suspected of terrorism. Walker tossed the case against the telecommunication carriers in June after Congress, with then-Senator Barack Obama's vote, immunized the carriers from being sued for their alleged conduct. The 2008 legislation authorized the terror surveillance program as outlined by Bush. The decision by Walker, which is on appeal, gave new focus to the two lawsuits targeting the government that Walker tossed Thursday. So, in essence, it was really summed up there by the EFF, Cindy Cohn, saying that if you do it and do it big enough, you can't bring a lawsuit against the American government. So, as long as the government goes big, they're perfectly fine. So I don't think that this would apply in general to the public as well. Say somebody stole credit cards from a database and included every, you know, a good amount of cross-section of credit cards across the United States. And I don't think the courts would rule, well, it affected pretty much all the American public, so we're going to toss it out. Because you can't really bring it when it's everybody involved. It's just too big. Now, that's kind of illogical. If something is so horrific and horrendous and far-reaching, you can't judge on it. It doesn't make any sense. That should be even more important than if it happened to one or two or three people. If it affects everybody in a whole country, it should be the most important thing of all and boost it ahead of other things. This is ridiculous, and I'm glad that the EFF is following up on this and appealing that lawsuit. And I'm sure most people in the U.S. would agree with that if something is so big that it can't be taken to court, that it should be taken to court. That means it should be taken to court. It should be the opposite of unimportant. Anyway, copyright news from the UK. Anti-piracy scheme, a scam, and legal blackmail, say UK lords. And that's where the clip I got off the top of the show is from. It's from torrentfreak.com. Several UK lords have criticized the practices of law firms that's sending out warning letters to alleged copyright infringers demanding big payments. These schemes have been labeled a scam, and the lawyers operating them accused of harassment, bullying, and intrusion, and legal blackmail in the House of Lords. ACS Law, since 2007, UK file sharers have been threatened with legal action if they refuse to pay several hundred pounds in damages for alleged copyright infringements. It started with the respected law firm Davenport Lyons, but then when they dropped out as their reputation started to suffer, ACS Law stepped in. Although the threats and accusations are often sent to the wrong people due to shoddy evidence gathered techniques employed, thousands have paid off the copyright holders, fearing they would end up in more trouble if they ignored the threats. The scheme has proven to be profitable for all parties involved, except those receiving the letter. Leaked documents have shed light on these practices, revealing that the core motivation of the companies involved is simply to generate as much cash as possible. It will hardly surprise anyone when we allege that the ACS Law and fellow anti-piracy outfits are clearly abusing copyright for profit. However, it is good to see that our views are being supported by several lords in the UK. In recent weeks, the law firms sending out these mass copyright infringement notices have been discussed in the UK House of Lords. The video below shows Lord Clement Jones labeling the operation as a scam. It's good to go and watch those videos that are embedded in this website. Very interesting. It is surprising that the UK copyright holders, some of which have leased copyrights from other companies for the sole purpose of cashing in on alleged allegations of file sharers, can demand the personal details of thousands of alleged file sharers without having to provide hard evidence. In most other countries, this would be prohibited due to privacy concerns. Now, I'm going to stop right there, and that is really interesting right there. They're actually selling off blocks of people, blocks of copyright violations. Like, a large company, say, Warner Music, could sell off their rights to sue citizens, say, they could sell it for $1 million, and then this company would take that and buy the possibility of suing their customers of Warner Music, of alleged infringers, and take that and go and sue these people and collect that money and make $2 million, $3 million. Now, this is what is done with credit card debt or any kind of debt. What you do is, say somebody owes this large company like 50, 100 people, 200 people owe this company $50 each or $100 each. What they do is sell this debt off at 50% of the cost or 10% of the cost and sell it to a collections agency. And this is how it's done. They sell it to collections agency for a percentage. And then this collections agency goes out after these people who owe the debt to the company, and they harp on them and what they're doing is wagering that they're going to make more money back than they bought the debt for. And now what's happening here is the same as copyright holders. Copyright holders are selling off their interest in suing people, or allegedly suing people, because they're not suing people, because people are paying up. They sell their almost their right to sue people in the name of a large corporation in efforts to hope that they get back the money that they bought this debt for, this alleged debt, this non-real debt of people downloading music, or allegedly downloading music, because they're not doing even a very good job of doing this, because they're sending it to people who have never done this before, who don't download the copyrighted material. I'll go on. Lord Lucas has raised this problematic issue, saying that the Lords must do something to ensure that citizens' personal details are not given out to companies like ACS Law willy-nilly. Anti-piracy lawyers accused of harassment, bullying, and intrusion in the House of Lords. Like many file sharers, some Lords would like to put an end to this copyright abuse, with Lord Lucas accusing the law firm involved of harassment, bullying, and intrusion. But the criticism of ACS Law didn't stop there, noting that it could cost around $10,000 for those accused to protest their innocence, but a payment of only £500 to make the accusations go away. Lord Lucas called the scheme straightforward legal blackmail. For the public's sake, we hope they come up with a solution to end this madness. In the meantime, anyone accused by ACS Law can learn exactly how this scheme operates and how to defend themselves efficiently by downloading the speculative invoicing handbook from consumer group being threatened. Next story, free culture news from the UK. Photographers protest over UK terror search laws. From bbc.co.uk. Professional and amateur photographers have gathered in London's Trafalgar Square to protest against terror stop and searches. The photographers say police are intimidating people with cameras in tactics to target possible terrorists. Last week, in the European Court of Human Rights ruled the power to stop people without suspicion was indiscriminate. The government is appealing, say it is vital to make cities a hostile place for any possible attacker. Freelance photographer and writer Mark Vallee, who helped organize the protest, said, "It's quite surreal today, but we're pleased with the support. It's quite obvious that professional photographers across the country are being searched because they are photographers, not because they are suspicious. It is a common law right to take pictures in public places, and we are here to show that." The demonstration comes after a year of rising tension between professional photographers and police over the exact scope of Section 44 of the Terrorism Act 2000. The special stop and search power allows police in specifically designated areas to stop people without suspicion of wrongdoing in an attempt to make it difficult for potential attackers to move around. It is used in some key areas of London and other cities or airports where counter-terrorism officers suspect that violent extremists may be looking for targets. According to the latest available figures, some 36,000 people were stopped under the power between April and June last year. Wow, that's a lot of people to be busy stopping taking pictures. 36,000 people. But photographers said that the practical effect has been that increasing numbers of people with cameras are being left intimidated, angry, and afraid after being asked to account for their actions. Shami Chakrabarty, director of human rights group Liberty, said it has warned of the dangers of blanket stop and search for a decade. She said, "We have been completely vindicated by the Court of Human Rights, and in the coming weeks, MPs will have the chance to change this law. Let's hope they step up to their responsibilities." A series of controversial incidents over the past year have included photographers being stopped while taking pictures of landmarks and public buildings. A separate counterterrorism law, which in theory restricts the rights to photograph police officers, has added to the tensions. Shortly before Christmas, Assistant Commissioner John Yates, the head of counterterrorism at the Metropolitan Police, warned officers they risk losing public confidence if they did not use Section 44 powers sensibly. Now, this is this is important for even their tourism industry. What do tourists do? They go to other countries and take pictures. That's what I do when I go on vacation. I am a photographer and I go to other countries and take photos. Now, I've never been stopped. I've been to London, but it was quite a while ago, 2003. And so this wasn't as big back in 2003. But I would be very intimidated of any country that's just stopping tourists taking photos. Now, really, taking photos, is that really going to counter terrorism? There's public photos of everything. You can go on the internet and find photos of every angle, almost, of every major city. This is not going to stop terrorism. This is going to promote hostility in your city. And thankfully, people are stepping up and showing the ridiculousness of these kinds of laws. And if you'd go to this story, and I think it has a picture of the protest, a very peaceful protest, of just thousands of photographers going out and taking hundreds of photos gathered in a group. They're taking photos of themselves and each other and the surrounding area, but it's quite a sight to see. And I'm glad they're stepping up and showing the ridiculous of this theater security that is going on, where they could use their efforts much better instead of harassing innocent people. They're taking away the natural culture of people to photograph things that are going on around them. Now, if there's a necessity, if somebody's doing something suspicious, they need to have some sort of way to discriminate between the people that are just taking photographs and people that are doing something that they might deem something suspicious. Now, by stopping everybody who's taking a photo, you know, you've seen this on television or you've heard of it before, people going into a store and say, you can't take photos in here. Well, of course, there's no real good reason to not take photos in a store. It's a store. Thousands of people walk through it every day and can look. But that's private property. This is public property, and people can take photos of public property. That's why it's called public property. Unless they're going to lock it down and say this portion of the city is not public property, which is what they're trying to do with that Section 44, then they can't say you can't take photos here. Now, are they going to cordon off cities and put everybody in plastic bubbles? Now, they're making it hostile. They're going to lose what cities are all about and what community is all about there. It's kind of sad. In World Copyright News, the Public Domain Manifesto. This is from digital-scholarship.org, sent in by DC. Communia has released the Public Domain Manifesto and seeks organizations and individuals to sign it. The Creative Commons, James Boyle, and Lawrence Lessig are among the current signatories. Here's an excerpt. The public domain is the rule. Copyright protection is the exemption. Since copyright protection is granted only with respect to original forms of expression, the vast majority of data, information, and ideas produced worldwide at any given time belongs to the public domain. In addition, the information that is not eligible for protection, the public domain is enlarged every year by works whose term of protection expires. The combined application of the requirement for protection and the limited duration of the copyright protection contribute to the wealth of the public domain, so as to ensure access to our shared culture and knowledge. Number two, copyright protection should last only as long as necessary to achieve a reasonable compromise between protecting and rewarding the author for his intellectual labor and safeguarding the public interest in the dissemination of culture and knowledge, goes on. Number three, what is in the public domain must remain in the public domain, and it goes on. Number four, the lawful user of a digital copy of a public domain work should be free to reuse, copy, and modify such work. Number five, contracts are technical protection measures that restrict access to and reuse of public domain works must not be enforced. Now, this is a very explicit, comprehensive rundown of what public domain and copyright should be. It is really well written and is worth a read, and it's worth a read for all the pirate parties out there if they're looking to adopt wordage for things to be passed in their countries, to take a look at what has been put out here. It is excellent. So hop over to that website and take a look. And this is just one portion of the Public Domain Manifesto. There's much, much more to it. Take a look. In world privacy news, help EFF research web browser tracking. This is from EFF.org, an excellent organization. What fingerprints does your browser leave behind as you surf the web? Traditionally, people assume that they can prevent a website from identifying them by disabling cookies on their web browser. Unfortunately, this is not the whole story. When you visit a website, you're allowing that site to access a lot of information about your computer's configuration. Combined, this information can create a kind of fingerprint, a signature that could be used to identify you and your computer. But how effective would this kind of online tracking be? EFF is running an experiment to find out. Our new website, Panopticlick, will anonymously log the configuration and version information of your operating system, your browser, and your plugin, and compare it to our database of 5 million other configurations. Then it will give you a uniqueness score, letting you see how easily identifiable you might be as you surf the web. Adding your information to our database will help EFF evaluate the capabilities of internet tracking and advertising companies who are already using the techniques of this sort to record people's online activities. They develop these methods in secret and don't always tell the world what they found. But this experiment will give us more insight into the privacy risk posed by browser fingerprinting and help web users to protect themselves. So what I did is I went there and took the test. This is really interesting, and you should do it yourself as well to help the EFF out and to check out how unique your digital footprint is, because this is not based on your IP address. This is not based on cookies. This is not based on anything you've heard before. This is based on signatures that you leave behind that your web browser passes on to the website that you may not be aware of. So after testing mine, a very scary result appeared. It said, your browser fingerprint appears to be unique among the 128,111 tested so far. Currently, we estimate that your browser has a fingerprint that conveys at least 16.97 bits of identifying information. So what that says to me is that my browser is configured so uniquely with unique plugins and all the other information that it passes on to the website, such as my screen size, my browser version information, all the plugins that I use on my browser, that it is completely unique. I am the only one among 128,000 people that have run this test so far to have the exact same browser configuration. Now, if you think about that, and if a number of these companies join up behind the scenes and share this information and data, it takes only one that knows my information, such as Amazon.com or some forum that I'm on or some bank. Not saying that the banks would use this to share information with advertising companies or other places, but a lot of places that you may not want to have your information all of a sudden do have your information because it only takes one, and I am unique. If one person knew it, they could share it with all the advertisers, everybody that's associated with this, and I would be identified easily, because I'm the only one with this configuration. So what I expect that what they're going to be doing is to analyze all the different browser fingerprints and give a database and give one that is the most common one. And I see plugins in the future for browsers or browser capabilities that is able to be set, so that you can set your browser to the most common browser settings so your fingerprint looks like 100,000 other people's fingerprints or a million people's fingerprints. So they won't be able to discern who is visiting their website. Now, if you don't want to give a website your information, if you're trying to browse anonymously, and I'm using that in quotes, anonymously, you're not really browsing anonymously. You're browsing uniquely. Now, you may not give their information to this one website, but the other website does have your information, and now they all do. So take a surf over to EFF and help them out in this interesting experiment, which will result in very interesting results and help us all in the end to protect our privacy when privacy is needed, and especially helpful for people in other countries where they are oppressed so that they cannot be identified uniquely, so that they can't get in trouble for things they say on the internet that their government doesn't like, or maybe they're speaking out of turn about a company that's violating laws, and so they can't be targeted. Anything that could be used to oppress people in situations where they are speaking out completely lawfully, but the repercussions could come back to them if they're identified. Please help this, and it's very interesting. Even for your own sake, it's very interesting to have these results. In world copyright news, estimating the cost of a three strikes and you're out system. This is from the excellent blog of michaelgeist.ca. Canadian officials travel to Guadalajara, Mexico this week to resume negotiations on the still secret ACTA agreement. That's redundant. Still secret ACTA. The discussion is likely to turn to the prospect of supporting three strikes and you're out systems that could result in thousands of people losing access to the internet based on the three... to the internet based on three allegations of copyright infringement. Leaked ACTA documents indicate that encouraging this adoption of three strikes, often euphemistically described as graduated response for the way internet providers gradually send increasingly threatening warnings to subscribers, has been proposed for possible inclusion in the treaty. Now, we've all heard this before, but he does some analysis. My weekly technology law column notes that while supporters claim the three strikes is garnering increased international acceptance, the truce is implementing in many countries is a mixed bag. Countries such as Germany and Spain have rejected it, acknowledging criticisms that loss of internet access for up to a year for entire households is a disproportionate punishment for unproven non-commercial infringement. Those countries that have ventured forward have faced formidable barriers. New Zealand withdrew a three strikes proposal in the face of public protests. A much watered-down version was floated at the end of last year. The UK's proposal has been hit with hundreds of proposed amendments at the House of Lords, and France's adventure with the three strikes has included initial defeat in the French National Assembly, a constitutional court ruling that the plan was unconstitutional, and delayed implementation due to privacy concerns for the country's Data Protection Commissioner. Much of the three strikes debate has focused on the impact of internet users, yet the price of establishing such systems have scarcely been discussed. This may be changing due to the UK's government's own estimation on the likely costs borne by the internet providers and taxpayers in establishing and maintaining a three strikes system. Initial government estimates pegged the expense to the internet providers alone as much as £500 million, this is for the UK, over 10 years. This includes the cost of identifying subscribers, notifying them of alleged infringements, running call centers to answer questions, and investing in new equipment to manage the system. As a result, the UK government estimates that 40,000 people could lose internet access due to the anticipated increases in subscriber fees. The UK recording industry has challenged these numbers, but there is reason to believe they actually understate the actual economic impact. The UK estimates focus exclusively on the internet provider costs, but provide no accounting for actual enforcement of the system. When court and regulatory costs are factored into the equation, the taxpayer burden runs into the hundreds of millions. Moreover, the UK estimates are consistent with the 2006 Industry Canada Commission study on the costs of internet provider notification schemes. The study concluded that the cost of a single notification was $11.73 for larger internet providers, more than 100,000 subscribers, and $32.73 for smaller internet providers. Now, this is talking on a per notification basis. So you have to take into account all the databases that are behind this, the cost to possibly the ISP for losing a customer, the cost for the customer service person to phone the person, the time taken from start to finish to do the whole process. Considering the sheer number of notifications last summer, Bell Canada acknowledged receiving 15,000 notifications each month. The costs quickly run into the millions of dollars. So there is more than just the social impact going on here with these three strikes laws that are being proposed, supposedly proposed in ACTA. We don't know because it's all secretive. The impact that this could have on the cost to internet providers and the social cost to people being cut off for three alleged infringements. This is huge. People, they aren't taken into account, and what's going to happen is it's going to cost the whole country for implementing these things much more than the costs for recovering any alleged copyright infringements going on. So this is a lose-lose situation for everyone. And really, are the companies that are trying to push these laws through, the corporations that are allegedly losing money, are they going to win over any customers from these people that are now without internet? Are the people without internet going to all of a sudden rush out and buy the DVDs and CDs that they're allegedly not downloading now? They're gonna win over these new customers? Oh, I'm sorry, I've violated your copyrights, and now I have no internet, and I've been sued for $1 million. I think I'll go out and spend all my money on your DVDs and CDs. You've won me over, and now I love your corporation and would love to give you all my money. No, this is going to garner bad feelings towards these companies. And as these things go through and ACTA gets keep pushing through, it's going to expose which these companies that are pushing this kind of stuff, and it's going to expose a revolt. And hopefully the revolt takes the form of people dropping buying these things from the companies that are putting out. You don't need to watch these movies. You don't need to listen to those corporate music and the corporate movies. There's lots of companies out there that are not suing their customers. There's enough media to go around. Lots of entertainment out there. You don't need to go beg from the large ones. Net neutrality news from the US. FCC's net neutrality plan would permit blocking of BitTorrent. It's from EFF.org. Remember what put the debate over net neutrality into high gear? In 2007, EFF and the Associated Press confirmed suspicions that Comcast was clandestinely blocking BitTorrent traffic. It was one of the first clear demonstrations that ISPs are technologically capable of interfering with your internet connection, and they may not even tell you about it. After receiving numerous complaints, the FCC in 2008 stepped in and threw the book at Comcast, requiring them to stop blocking BitTorrent. The Comcast BitTorrent experience put net neutrality at the top of the FCC agenda. Yet now, the FCC has formally issued draft net neutrality regulations. They have a huge copyright loophole in them. A loophole that would theoretically permit Comcast to block BitTorrent just like they did in 2007, simply by claiming that it was reasonable network management intended to prevent the unlawful transfer of content. You heard that right. Under these conditions, the new proposed net neutrality regulations would allow the same practices that net neutrality was first invoked to prevent, even if these ISP practices ended up inflicting collateral damage on perfectly lawful content and activities. When we saw the loophole, we had to ask ourselves, is this real net neutrality? And the answer was simply no. The entertainment industry is already pressuring ISPs to become copyright cops. Carving a copyright loophole in net neutrality would leave your lawful activities at the mercy of overbroad copyright filtering schemes. And we already have plenty of experience with copyright enforcers targeting legitimate users by mistake, careless, or design. If net neutrality regulations are to be taken seriously at all, then the loophole must be closed. Sign the petition to demand real net neutrality from the FCC, and you can get that link from the EFF.org's website. So what they're proposing is that they can shut off your internet if it is under the guise of reasonable network management and to prevent the unlawful transfer of content. So if they think your internet traffic is causing network management problems, then they can shut down your connection. Now, they get to decide what network management problems are. So if you're using up too much bandwidth, you're causing network management problems. And they can shut you down or slow you down, even if it is a widely accepted thing, such as BitTorrent. BitTorrent is used for the distribution of media. Steam uses BitTorrent. A lot of other gaming sites use BitTorrent to distribute games and data. I use BitTorrent in some of my projects. Are they going to be blocking my projects from customers? This is legitimate, lawful content on the internet. How are they going to distinguish between lawful and unlawful Linux ISOs and copyrighted works that people don't want distributed? How are they going to make the distinguishing marks? Are they going to look through everything? Or are they just going to say, that's BitTorrent, shut them down. BitTorrent is illegal. It's not illegal. It's a protocol on the internet. If they don't like the traffic that's going through their internet, they can shut you down. If they think you're going beyond what they think is a reasonable use of the internet, going to YouTube, getting your email, and looking at web pages, that's all they really want you to do. They'd rather you not even go to YouTube because that uses too much bandwidth. Email and web pages, that's about it. Maybe a few videos here and there. Because if they don't evolve with what people are using on the internet, they're going to fall behind. They're taking your money. They should build up their infrastructure based on how much money they're taking in. If they're not making money, they should charge more money to you. It's a competitive business. And if they are charging more money, you can go to another provider. But shutting you down based on what they don't like and what they can look at, if they're not the internet police. They should not be enforcing copyright. They should not be enforcing the laws. That is what the police are for. And that is not what the ISPs are for. They are common carriers. They carry your bits, they take your money. They should not be looking at your private communications. That is not their job. Copyright news from the UK. Playing of recorded music in prisons to be banned. It's from theguardian.co.uk. The playing of recorded music in communal areas of prisons is to be banned from next week after authorities ruled it to be too expensive and unpopular with the public to pay for radio and CD licenses. Prisoners in workshops, kitchens, and restrooms will not be allowed to switch on music radio stations or play CDs from Monday, according to a Ministry of Justice document. Ian Tory, a senior official in the National Offender Management Services, has written to a prison governors saying that they are bound by the 1988 Copyright Act, which stipulates that a license must be obtained to play music in public. This is defined as outside of the home. And of course, prison is outside of the home. Prison is prison. In view of the high cost, the financial constraints on the service are likely, and the likely perception of spending large amounts of money on music for prisoners, the decision has been taken not to purchase a license, Pori wrote in the international note on 6th of January. The prison authorities have agreed to pay for licenses to allow DVDs and videos to be shown. Pori's note lists 48 film studios, including 20th Century Fox and DreamWorks, for which a license has been obtained. The second list of 9 studios, including Warner Brothers and Buena Vista, requires each prison to fill out a 6-point questionnaire every quarter. This asks the prisoner to confirm what it is a prison, to confirm that it is a prison under the 1952 Prison Act, and what the different uses of every television set in the institution. The internal note says that showing films on DVD or videos to groups of prisoner or staff, either in communal areas or via in-cell television systems, is considered to be a public performance for which a license is required. The Tories criticized the ban on playing of recorded music. Alan Duncan, the Shadow Prisons Minister, said, "It seems crazy that a prisoner can listen to the radio in their cell, but not when they're doing something useful in the prison estate." Now, it is a controversial kind of story because it is a prison, and they're there for reform and punishment at the same time. And paying for music for them to listen to is, in the eyes of the public, not something that the public would want to be paying for. But it's the type of enforcement that is coming down and the wordage that they're using to enforce the laws of music and DVDs and movies is the concerning part, where they're locking down more and more on how music is used and how movies are used. They're locking down culture. And I can see this extending more and more. You laugh at it now, but it could get into the homes of the public, where they would ask you for surveys of how you're using your movies and how you're playing your music. What if you're playing out in your backyard and you have a barbecue party going on and you're playing music out in the backyard and the music is spilling over into your neighbor's yard? Or say the RIAA doesn't like the neighbors that are coming over to listen to the music, because that's not personal playing, that's a public performance. Now, I don't think I'm going too far anymore. This is something that could be realized in the future. They're setting it up so we're getting more and more used to these violations of listeners. Now my friend has done a show called The Afternow, where in the future, in this theoretical future, there's something called a listener's license, where everybody has to sign up for a license to play and listen to music, and they have to abide by laws. And I can see it being more and more implemented and getting into people's psyche that music is not something that is free anymore, free to listen to. It is something that is completely regulated by the corporations, and everybody has to look over their shoulder to make sure they're not violating any copyright laws when they're doing this. Now, every time you put on a DVD or you play some music, are you consciously thinking about, am I violating copyright laws? Or when you're using it on your computer, you're now thinking, am I doing something wrong? Could I be thrown into jail? Could the cops bust down my door for using music or using this movie in a certain way? Am I remixing things wrong? Is this too long of a clip of a piece of music that could get me into trouble? Now, this is something that is very worrying and is becoming increasingly worrying for people. And it creates a resentment towards the music corporation, and puts me in a mood to just forget about the large corporations and go after the indie bands and listen to music you know is actually free. And everybody should take a look at those bands that are under Creative Commons license or a less restrictive license, so that you can support them and go to their concerts and buy their merchandise and their t-shirts and support them. In Pirate Party news, U.S. Pirate Party election results. They had a recent election that didn't catch on to last week's show, but I'm sure they sent it out to all of their U.S. Pirate Party members, and they had an election, and the results are in. Congratulations are in order to Brittany Phelps in the race for our new administrator. It was a good race, and ultimately both candidates presented their arguments well, and I applaud the effort. Regardless of how you feel about either one, they had both wanted what they felt for best for the party, and they should be respectable to anyone. Brittany Phelps won by 72% to 27% for Jay Emerson. Goes on, it's no secret that lately the Pirate Party has been going through an awkward stage in our development, with a temporary leader appointed for 30 days while we held new elections. Obviously, we owe a huge thanks to you, Mr. Bradley Hall, as he was selected as the administrator pro tempore and did a fantastic job organizing the elections and made sure they went through as smoothly as possible. We had worked very hard as a party to get where we are, and I know in the coming months we will be seeing great advancements, not only from the administrator, but from our entire party. The energy that this entire situation has caused has only spurred people to stand up and take action instead of watching idly by. We're going to use this situation as a positive and make it slingshot us forward. It is a great time to be a member of the Pirate Party, and if you were hesitant about joining before, now is the time to join. Now is when we want you the most, because our new path of amazing achievement starts with an army of people who believe in real progress. So if you live in the United States, you might want to check out the U.S. Pirate Party at pirate-party.us. And here's an interesting tongue-in-cheek look at copyright from a blog I ran across. It's titled, Offline Book Lending Costs U.S. Publishers Nearly $1 Trillion. Hot on the heels of the story in Publishers Weekly that publishers could be losing out as much as $3 billion to online book piracy comes a sudden realization of a much larger threat to the viability of the book industry. Apparently, over 2 billion books were loaned last year by a cabal of organizations found in nearly every American city and town. Using the same advanced projective mathematics used in the study cited by the Publishers Weekly, GoToHellman has computed the publishers could be losing sales opportunities totaling over $100 billion per year, losses which extend back to at least the year 2000. These lost sales dwarf the online piracy reported yesterday, and indeed even the global book publishing business itself. From what we've been able to piece together, the book lending takes place in libraries. On entering one of these dens, patron may view a dazzling array of books, periodicals, even CDs and DVDs, all available to anyone willing to disclose valuable personal information in exchange for a card. But there's an ominous silence pervading these ersatz sanctuaries, enforced by the stern demeanor of staff and the glares of other patrons. Although there's no admission charge and it doesn't cost anything to borrow a book, there's always the threat of the onerous overdue bill for the hapless borrower who forgets to continue the cycle of not paying for copyrighted material. To get the bottom of the story, GoToHellman has dispatched its senior piracy analyst to Boston, where a mass meeting of the alleged book traffickers is to take place. Over 10,000 are expected at the ALA Midwinter event. Even at the Amtrak station in New York City this morning, at the very heart of the U.S. publishing industry, book trafficking culture was evident, with many travelers brazenly displaying the tote bags used to transport printed contraband. As soon as I got off the train, I was surrounded by even more of this crowd, calling themselves librarians. They talk about promoting literacy, education, culture, and economic development, which are, of course, code words for the use and dispersal of intellectual property. They readily admit to their activities and rationalize them because they're perfectly legal in the U.S., at least for now. Typical was Suzanne from D.C., who told me that she's been involved in the lending operations for over 15 years. This confirms our estimate that lending has been going on for over 10 years, beyond even Google's memory. Our trillion-dollar estimate may be thus on the conservative side. Of course, it's impossible to tell how many of these lent books would have been purchased legally if libraries were not an option. We're not even considering the huge potential losses to publishers when used books are resold for pennies on the black markets. The communications backbone for this vast empire appears to be Twitter. Already there is constant chatter on the pound ALAMW10 hashtag. Most messages are clearly coded references to illicit transactions. For example, a trafficker with the alias @libacat tweets, "Have to be on the bus to the airport at 6:41 tomorrow morning to make it to the airport to get my plane to ALAMW10. At first glance, it seems like a mundane tweet about travel plans, but the breathtaking ordinariness and triple redundancy is more likely a secret code. How else to understand @Skullfords? Correction, retweet of Sunjan Library replying to @BPLBoston tweet, "Curling my toes in joy at the thought of visiting your library." I've attended this meeting before. When I register for the book lending confab, I'll be presented with an encrypted document labeled the program, which once decoded will tell me where I can meet other book traffickers discussing arcane trafficker lore and drink trafficker beer. It's thick with the secrecy code words like YALSA, LITA, and NMRT, and no apparent rhyme or reason in its layout, evidently to frustrate outside investigators. I'll be lucky if I can find a bathroom. Very funny stuff. And that is kind of how things are being viewed for other things other than books. And even it looks at ebooks that way, where people don't even realize that libraries are giving away free media. And they've oft forgotten in this copyright debate that libraries have been around for hundreds of years, freely available for anybody who walks in. You don't have to pay a dime. And how has the book industry gone? Quite well, in fact, over these hundreds of years, despite the absolute free access, and you don't have to pay a dime to get any book you want. But still, the industry moves on somehow. So I'm going to leave you with an interview conducted with Andrew Robinson from the UK Pirate Party talking about the Digital Economy Bill. And this is, he was interviewed by Rory Sillon-Jones of the BBC. And remember, if any of these stories have interested you, please check out your local Pirate Party to find out more of what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. If you have any news stories you'd like to hear in the show, questions, or comments, just head over to piratepartyradio.com and submit them through the form on the website. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
So I'm at an event in Westminster where various organizations, companies are lobbying against the Digital Economy Bill and particularly the measures against illegal file sharing. TalkTalk is here. Charles Dunstan is doing the rounds, saying it's a matter of human rights. It's not a commercial thing. Liberty's here. Witch is here, talking about people who've been caught up already in a sweep against illegal file sharing, but are innocent victims. And I've also got with me now Andrew Robinson from the Pirate Party. What's the Pirate Party?
Basically, the reason we're here is that we're campaigning to legalise file sharing. It's one of our three core policies. And we think that the only way to solve this big dispute and actually get 7 million file sharers to not feel that they're being persecuted by the government and the content owners, as who are very different to the artists themselves, by the way, is legalisation. Otherwise, we're going to try and fit 7 million cases through a court system that only handles 2 million cases on an average year.
File sharing is legal, though, as long as it's not copyrighted content, surely. So you're saying copyright should basically be abolished, are you?
No, copyright should be there to do what copyright was originally designed to do, which is reward artists for creating creative work. The problem is we've gone from the original idea of copyright to the situation we have today, where it's a mechanism for lawyers to send out letters bullying customers, and the government are going to introduce measures that mean that even I'm innocent isn't actually going to be a defence against the false accusations of copyright infringement.
So what would you say to artists, as well as music industry figures, who say, how can we possibly survive if people can take our music for nothing? How are we to be paid if our music is free online?
Well, essentially you're asking the same question that publishers have to face, which is how can we possibly make money when the government funds libraries that give our copyrighted content away for free? The answer is you just need a slightly different business model. And because the manufacturing costs of digital files have gone right down to zero, that means new business models are possible that are going to get around this problem.
But what business model is going to be attractive? I mean, let's take Spotify, for example, which will only survive if people end up subscribing, actually paying money. What business is going to be attractive if the alternative is a business model, i.e. file sharing, that is free? How can you compete with free?
It's important to understand that the way free file sharing actually works is that it works as a brilliant way of getting free advertising for bands. And the problem with the vast majority of bands out there is not that they're being pirated. The point is that they're obscure and nobody's heard of them. And the only way you're going to walk into a record shop and buy an album by a band you've never heard of is if you get a chance to hear the music and decide you like it. People always want to contribute to bands. People always want to go to concerts, buy the T-shirts, and all those things can easily be monetized. It's the getting the public to know that you're a really good artist that is the reason you currently give away 90-95% of all your money to a record company to get publicity. File sharing gives you the publicity for free.
And briefly, what are your plans as a political party? Are you going to be standing in the general election?
Yes, we're going to run as many candidates as we can afford to. We're a very small party. We've only started up 6 months ago, so we're only just getting off the ground. We see the general election is a great way to raise our profile and get people to take us seriously in the political arena. We think there's an awful lot of votes and an awful lot of public opinion that clamping down on file sharers is exactly the wrong thing to be doing.
OK, one view of the file sharing debate. This is a room packed with people determined to kill the bill. Of course, music industry lobbyists will be trying to do exactly the opposite.